Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Harvard Business School is famous for many things, including its case studies. It has around 10,000 case studies in all, which are used by business schools all over the world. The thing is, most of these case studies feature white males. So one Harvard professor is trying to change that by creating new case studies that feature black entrepreneurs, as well as a new course that focuses on black business leaders. Zeninjor Enwemeka is a reporter for WBUR's new business and technology team, Bostonomics, and she's working on a story about a new kind of case study, and she joins us now to tell us about it. Hi there, Zeninjor.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so tell us more about this initiative. What exactly is it trying to achieve?
So this initiative is all about expanding the conversation around what a successful business person looks like and what it takes to be successful in the business world. So the initiative was started by Professor Stephen Rogers at Harvard Business School. He's written 14 new case studies that feature black protagonists, and he's teaching them in a new course this spring focused on black business leaders and entrepreneurs.
I'm going to just jump in here for a second for Zeninjor, because it suddenly occurred to me that maybe not everyone knows exactly what a case study means. And we're just talking about, you know, a kind of a big booklet, a pamphlet, a report that presents a particular business challenge that an organization faced, interviews with leaders in those businesses, lots of charts and things like that.
Yeah, so case studies, they're the key teaching method at Harvard Business School and other business schools, frankly. But yes, it's basically how students learn the fundamentals of business. So finance, management, investing, the case studies will highlight a particular business person and go over a challenge or issue that they might be facing in their business. Mm-hmm. And Harvard Business School's case studies are primary source materials for a lot of schools around the country and around the world. I spoke to Stephen Rogers about this, and he says it's really crucial that all students learn about diverse business leaders.
Well, it's imperative that, first of all, our black students see role models. They see people, great businessmen and businesswomen who look like them. It's also important that our non-black students, that they see black brilliance in action, that they see, quite frankly, to counter the stereotypes that we see in the media, that black men and black women are brilliant business-wise, as well as entertainment and athletically.
Yeah, so the power of these examples of successful black entrepreneurs in these case studies, I can see how that might make a big difference. But how is Professor Stephen Rogers going about doing this?
Yeah. So, I mean, he's done the work with his particular class. He has this new course. He has these new case studies. But he's also working with other professors at Harvard Business School to create other case studies. And with the idea being that getting these diverse case studies into other classes throughout the curriculum, particularly the classes that are required for students. And that's really important because this type of exposure can really influence students once they enter the business world. So the idea is that if they're exposed to diversity now, it can influence their decisions around something like hiring in the workplace. I actually spoke to another Harvard Business School professor about this. His name is Paul Gompers, and he's done a lot of research around hiring practices and the representation of women and minorities in business. And here's what he had to say.
There's a force that we identify. It's called homophily. And that's the notion that people like to work with and gather with people who are like them. And this can lead to even just subtle biases in terms of who do you hire. That tendency can keep these groups that aren't currently part of the industry out of the industry.
So again, the idea there that exposure to diversity can help people kind of overcome subtle biases when it comes to in the workplace and hiring practices. And research shows that diverse companies perform better and have greater financial returns.
So what's the response then been to this initiative?
Well, Stephen Rogers says he's received nothing but positive responses from other professors who are now taking a closer look at their own case studies and trying to diversify them. And I spoke with several students as well who are really excited about this new course. I spoke with Latoya Mark. She's in her last year at Harvard Business School. She's also student body president. And she says these types of diverse studies, case studies, are really important for students like her who are the first in their family to pursue this type of career.
No one in my family has attended an Ivy League college. no one in my family has an MBA. This is like a unique experience where I don't have really anyone in my family I can look to. So I'm relying on mentors. I'm relying on professors like Professor Rogers. I'm relying on connections that I make with the protagonists to really look out for me to help to propel my career.
And that's exactly the kind of impact that Stephen Rogers is going for. And each of the case studies that Harvard Business School professors come up with are become part of the school's catalog, which are then sold all over the place. So the impact could be pretty far-reaching.
Absolutely, far and wide. You know, the other thing I was thinking about how important it is to diversify the kinds of organizations and business leaders that these case studies profile is that by doing so, you're also, by definition, asking business students to think more actively about diversity in the workplace, not just
Absolutely.
In hiring, but like, you know, the impact that diversity has on the workplace because they're looking at examples of it
Absolutely.
Built into the case studies themselves. So really exciting. Cool. I'm looking forward to seeing what more you do on this reported story. But Zanindra, before I let you go, there is another story I want to talk to you about that you have been covering extensively for WBUR, and that has to do with ride sharing, because we had this news out yesterday that thousands of drivers for ride hailing companies have failed these new state background checks here in Massachusetts. So what happened?
Yeah, so more than 8,000 drivers have failed the state's new background checks. These were drivers for Uber, Lyft, and Fastin. And this is all part of a new state system that's required by a law that was approved last year that put some regulations in place for ride-hailing companies. So basically now, if you want to drive for a ride-hailing company, you have to go through a two-part background check, one through the company and then one through the state. So these checks started in January. And I should note, too, that more than 62,000 drivers were approved by the state.
Okay, so 62,000 approved, but those 8,000 not. And why were they denied? Why'd they fail the background check?
So they mostly were denied because of suspended licenses, having multiple driving offenses, and in some cases because they just hadn't driven long enough to qualify to drive for a ride-hailing company. But there were some pretty serious offenses as well. Some drivers were denied for violent crimes, felony convictions, as well as sexual offenses.
Okay, but does this mean that these 8,000 drivers then are not driving for these ride-hailing companies right now?
Right, so they're no longer on the roads. Once you fail a state background check as a driver for a ride-hailing company, you're deactivated by the company. There is an appeals process that those drivers can go through. But, you know, all of this really raises some really major key issues. All of these drivers that were denied had been approved through the company background checks before the state background check. The ride-hailing companies say that basically their checks don't go as far back as the state, which does lifetime lookbacks on certain crimes.
Uh-huh.
And on the other hand, some say that the state checks are prohibitive and very restrictive and maybe might prevent some people from seeking job opportunities who maybe committed minor offenses a long time ago. So it's really interesting. And this is probably an issue that will come up and be fleshed out as the state works to finalize some of the regulations under this new law.
Absolutely. Really interesting. Zanindra Nwameko, reporter for WBUR's new business and technology team, Bostonomics. Thank you so much.
Sure thing, Meghna.
Well, despite what today's rainy weather might have you believe, baseball season is here. And for Rich Hill, that means the start of some big expectations. Back in December, the Milton native signed a 3-year, $48 million deal with the LA Dodgers. It's the first big money deal of his 12-year career, which included a brief stint with the Boston Red Sox. But Hill says it's the memory of his infant son, Brooks, not the money, that drives him. WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer met with Hill and has this story.
I'd like to thank my family who is here today, my wife, Caitlin, excuse me, our sons, Bryce and Brooks. You know, this is a great day for us.
That's Rich Hill at the press conference announcing his new contract with the Dodgers. The 37-year-old starting pitcher has persevered through control issues, injuries, stints with 8 different major league teams, plenty of time in the minors, and personal tragedy. You see, Hill's younger son Brooks wasn't actually at the press conference. Brooks was born on December 26, 2013. At first glance, he looked like a normal baby, but his arms and legs stayed contracted close to his body, hinting at bigger health issues. Doctors diagnosed Brooks with a malformed brain and failing kidneys that would require a transplant.
He was in so much pain every single day, and with the underlying issues of lissencephaly and the polymicrogyri, knowing that he is going to have an extremely difficult path for, you know, 2 to 5 years of the rest of his life if this kidney transplant was successful. You know, who are we doing this for? Are we doing it for ourselves to hold on to somebody, or are we doing it really in his best interest? When I look back on it, there's no right answer. But for us, we decided to take him home on hospice, and he ended up spending the last 3 days of his life, you know, at our house with us, and it was great.
Along the way, Hill and his wife tried to help their son Bryce understand what was happening to his baby brother.
It wasn't easy because you're telling, you know, a little kid at 2 years old that, you know, his brother isn't going to be here. You know, he was in the hospital with us with everything, he, you know, all the way through to the end, and he was amazing.
In February 2014, Brooks passed away. He was barely 2 months old. 10 days later, Hill reported to spring training with the Boston Red Sox.
The Boston Red Sox organization was amazing, saying, hey, look, take your time. But, you know, I think my wife and I, life keeps moving forward. It doesn't matter. You know, people die. Daily life continues. But with, you know, a different view on life and understanding of time and how precious life is.
During that season, Hill bounced from Boston's AAA affiliate Pawtucket to the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim to the New York Yankees. Between the Angels and Yankees, he was without a team. Unsure what the future held, he returned to Boston. To stay ready to pitch, he threw against a brick wall.
Anyway, 2 days goes by, and the Yankees call me back and say, hey, come on back to New York. And, you know, I don't know. So 2 days later, I'm back in the big leagues, you know, facing David Ortiz with, you know, runners on second and third after playing catch off the wall the day before. You know, it's crazy when you look, but those are things, those are little things that happened along the way.
In July 2015, that crazy journey took Hill to the independent leagues and the Long Island Ducks. Because independent league teams don't have any affiliation with Major League Baseball, they're often a last resort for pro players. Hill was no longer a prized young starter. He had to prove he could still pitch in the major leagues. In 2 starts for the Ducks, he did exactly that. By mid-September, he was starting for the Red Sox.
This year, as that is in there for strike three.
4 starts with the Red Sox changed the trajectory of his career and ultimately led to his opportunity with the Dodgers. And throughout Hill's climb from the Ducks to the Dodgers, his younger son, Brooks, has been there.
We made the decision to live for Brooks. So, you know, and with our son, Bryce, and keeping Brooks's memory alive, you know, not only for us and for everyone else, but also for him. So he understands that, you know, he had a brother. He had a brother, and he has a brother. I mean, he'll always bring up baby Brooks, and he'll mention, you know, he knows that he's in heaven, and, you know, if he finds a feather, he always thinks, you know, he says baby Brooks is leaving him little messages and stuff like that. So he may not be with us physically, but, you know, we believe that he's with us every single day.
It's LA Dodgers pitcher and Milton native Rich Hill in that report from WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.